Good morning. This is OneRadioNetwork.com. The telephone number is 888-663-6386. Email patrick@OneRadioNetwork.com. Nothing is more expensive than bad information. Know the source. OneRadioNetwork.com.
Well, welcome back. Hour two of our little show, and it is the third Tuesday of the month, and that brings us to Dr. Ray Peete, who's been at this nutrition healing game for a very, very long time. Dr. Ray Peete, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, how are you, Doc?
Very good.
You're looking pretty good. We have a picture of you up there. Sorry we couldn't get Dr. Peete on the video, because you're much of a somewhat of a Luddite. You don't have a microphone or camera or any of that stuff.
I have a new Dell monitor, but it doesn't have a camera.
Yeah. How's your life these days? What have you been doing? What are you most passionate about? What have you been thinking about in your world of health and healing?
I'm working on a newsletter on progesterone for this month, something I've been working on for 50 years, but always something new to think about.
Really? Now, what could possibly be going on with progesterone that would warrant that kind of attention in so long? Talk about that.
Partly that the industry is reverting to some of the old myths about it. The estrogen industry, people discover the dangers of estrogen, and that moves interest towards progesterone use. And then the estrogen industry has to defend itself because it's a multi-billion-dollar-a-year industry. And so they subsidize studies to make people worry about the risks of progesterone. They're starting to say that anything that estrogen is known to cause for 100 years, they're starting to say, well, really progesterone is involved in it. So it's distracting attention from the dangers of estrogen. And in the absence of any real information, they're just putting the thought out there that if estrogen does it, maybe progesterone is really involved somehow.
So when we talk about estrogen, are we speaking of the estrogenic foods?
Oh no.
No, the supplement.
The drugs. Yeah. The industry got started when someone synthesized a very simple chemical that triggered the whole fertility cycle in mice and rats. In the 30s, someone was thinking about the fact that chimney sweeps got cancer of the scrotum in the 18th century.
Oh, yeah.
From getting soot and not bathing. That led to someone putting soot on rabbits and finding that it was very carcinogenic, but they noticed that besides causing skin cancer, it triggered estrus in the female rabbits. And so they did extracts of soot and found that there were hundreds of estrogenic substances in soot.
In the soot, which came from the wood, I guess?
Yeah. You put a piece of cold metal or porcelain or something in the flame of a candle or a Bunsen burner or anything, and carbon spontaneously condenses at high temperature. Methane is a single atom of carbon with hydrogen, and when it burns, like if you have a cloud of natural gas and it explodes, it creates a cloud of soot, which results when the single atom of carbon surrounded by hydrogen condenses spontaneously into very symmetrical six-membered rings, and then 10 members, and on each ring being a hexagon of carbon atoms, some of the cyclic molecules are huge, and they, being very large, heavy, stick to each other and form these gobs of black material. Each molecule has this pattern, six-membered rings, which happens to be analogous to the steroid molecule. The steroid molecule has 3 6-membered rings and 1 5-membered ring. And when those don't have the proper oxygen atoms added in the right places, they act as estrogen. So you can get a million different estrogenic substances just from soot.
Wow, that's fascinating.
So the estrogen industry realized that everyone could have a patented, unique molecule and sell it as estrogen, which they called the female hormone, because it can be found in the ovary of a pregnant animal. So they advertised that they were selling the female hormone, which would, they said, would make women more fertile, because if it's the female hormone, being fertile is what supposedly characterizes women. And so they convinced even Harvard doctors, two of them did studies giving this basically a soot derivative, diethylstilbestrol, to pregnant women, claiming that it prevented miscarriage. But the animal studies in the 1930s and early 40s had all demonstrated that every kind of estrogen creates a miscarriage or stillbirth. My thesis advisor was one of the early researchers showing that as you increase the dose of estrogen, you can create an abortion or miscarriage at any stage of pregnancy. A very tiny dose will prevent implantation. A larger dose will cause miscarriage at the first week, a bigger dose at the second week, and so on. So they knew that estrogen caused miscarriages, but they were selling it to the public to prevent miscarriage.
Wow, just the opposite.
Simply because they could.
Yeah. So, so what's the takeaway? Oh, by the way, Ray Peet has a PhD in biology from the University of Oregon, specialization in physiology, and he's taught at the University of Oregon, Urbana College, Montana State University, and been involved in natural medicine for a very long time. I guess, you go back to, your early work was in the late 60s, right, with hormones?
Yeah, and my dissertation advisor, Arnold Soderwall, was the person who did these some of these early studies showing that that estrogen is a miscarriage.
So what is what's the biggest piece of misinformation to our lady, well, both ladies and gentlemen listening around the world about estrogen and progesterone? What is out there that most people believe that you believe is untrue?
Lots of doctors still refer to progesterone as the pregnancy hormone. Mm-hmm. Just a couple of weeks ago, someone said her doctor said she had her uterus removed, so she didn't need progesterone, because progesterone is only the pregnancy hormone. An absolutely ridiculous idea. Going back to the 1940s, doctors were taught that, to sell estrogen.
To get pregnant.
And they knew that estrogen causes cancer of the uterus. That was one of the early demonstrations of soot, that estrogens of all sorts, the first most sensitive organ is the uterus, then the breast, then the brain, then the lungs, then every other tissue, but it's just a matter of sensitivity, and the uterus is most sensitive. And then someone discovered, about 1945, it was already discovered that progesterone prevented uterine cancer from estrogen. And so they said, if you take estrogen and don't want uterine cancer, then you should take progesterone with it. But then the profitable thing was to do a hysterectomy, and so hysterectomies were being done. Everyone by the age of 30 or 35 was being urged to have a hysterectomy.
Really?
And without the uterus, and they said there's no need for progesterone. So the woman would have her ovaries and uterus removed, and they would refuse to give her progesterone because supposedly the uterus was the only organ that needed progesterone, being a pregnancy hormone. But in the 1930s, the ovaries were found to produce hundreds of times more quantity of progesterone than estrogen. Estrogen is really a minor hormone from the ovary. In experimental surgery, people have demonstrated that when they measured the amount of estrogen coming out of the ovary, as a control, they measured the blood coming out of the monkey's arm and found that the arm was producing as much estrogen as the ovary. Yeah. So the idea of estrogen as an ovarian hormone is really out of context, when every tissue of the animal produces a large amount of estrogen when it's under stress.
So laying it out as you have been, you can see how there's so much confusion in the medical world and the natural world about these hormones.
I thought a lot of that had been settled 30 or 40 years ago, but doctors are still being told, if you don't have a uterus, you don't need progesterone, when the brain is one of the biggest sources of progesterone. The placenta in pregnancy, the corpus luteum of the ovary, the brain contains 10 times the concentration of progesterone that the blood serum does. And the skin is another major source of progesterone. But when you take out the ovaries, you're putting an extra load on the brain and the skin to maintain the concentration of progesterone.
So what's the best advice you can give to our lady listeners, ladies around the world right now, regarding these two hormones, whether supplementation or just in general? I know you don't do medical advice, to help them to understand what they should or should not be looking at or doing or not doing.
Well, they're very likely to be told still 60, 70 years after it was proven false, told that estrogen is a lifelong female hormone. But old men rival women of the same age in the amount of estrogen being produced, because it's a stress hormone produced by tissue of any sort under stress. So question the claim that aging is evidence of a need for more estrogen. Old tissue increasingly tends to make estrogen. But the opposite is true. Progesterone failure is the primary thing that brings on menopause. The monthly surge of progesterone produces the monthly cycle, is the outstanding feature of the monthly cycle. When that stops, what is left is a surge of estrogen, which is no longer balanced by progesterone.
But that's the natural way it works for ladies, though, right? I mean, that's the way it's been set up to do a God thing, kind of, when the monthly cycle ends, like in menopause?
Well, the stress symptoms increase as menopause approaches, and the healthier the woman is, the longer she's able to maintain these monthly surges of progesterone. With supplementation, it's possible to keep menstruating to a much older age.
Is that a sign of health in general, the longer a lady menstruates?
I think so.
Oh, interesting. And then the hot flashes and all that, people have said that that's due to possible toxicity in the lady's body. Is that Can you relate to that?
Stress, even in the 20s or younger, I've known women having hot flashes that were resolved when they took thyroid or progesterone to normalize, prevent the stress.
Oh, with the thyroid functioning more appropriately, they're able to deal with the stress more easily.
Yeah, and one of the immediate chemical changes that produces the hot flash in the skin is a surge of nitric oxide, vasodilation.
Oh, and it dilates the blood vessels.
Yeah, and unopposed estrogen is a powerful activator of nitric oxide. And so I'm convinced that unopposed estrogen is the cause of the hot flashes. And doctors looking only at a blood test of estrogen will say no. At menopause, a woman's estrogen in the serum is very low. But this has been very competently studied. If you take a bit of tissue and compare it to the serum, this has been done not only in animals, but in women during menopause and in pregnancy and in the cycle. A bit of tissue compared to the serum, the tissue has 10 or 20 times more estrogen than the serum. And what makes the difference, what can raise the estrogen in the serum, is progesterone. So if you're deficient in progesterone, your tissue is likely to have 10 or 20 times more estrogen than shows up in the blood. When you have a normal cycle with progesterone, the progesterone does 8 or 10 different chemical actions, causing the tissue content of the estrogen to decrease. And as it decreases in the cell, it enters the bloodstream on its way to the kidneys and liver to be excreted. But in the absence of progesterone, those changes that release progesterone to be excreted, or release estrogen to be excreted, don't happen, and so the estrogen stays inside the cell at a concentration much higher than in the blood.
So that's part of the idea. You said unopposed estrogen, the opposition would be the balance of progesterone. And why does that get low? Does it just living on planet Earth with stress and diet and everything, why the progesterone levels go too low?
For pregnancy to be safe for both the mother and the baby, the placenta must produce a huge amount of progesterone every day, hundreds of milligrams per day, rising all the way through pregnancy to a peak approaching a gram a day. When the woman or animal is under stress, the stress changes the pituitary and all the other glands to avoid pregnancy. A stressed animal of any sort would be less likely to survive if it got pregnant. So the trick is that pregnancy is prevented by stress for the safety of the mother.
So it's a natural kind of evolutionary thing.
Yeah.
That's why.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it works the same way with bears or deers or girls.
Stress specifically turns off of progesterone for the avoidance of pregnancy.
Yeah. And we've talked to so many ladies over the years, they get stressed out, of course, because they want to get pregnant, right? It's hard, you know, because they're all worried and concerned about not getting, being able to get pregnant.
Yeah, there are lots of stories about a couple that gives up getting pregnant, adopt a kid, and immediately she gets pregnant.
That's
because
right.
The stress is relieved.
We have more kids than we need, right? So what's the idea, though, that many feel like a little bit of progesterone cream, just a dab or so, helps to keep testosterone levels better for guys? What's going on there? And is that a reliable thing to look at for guys listening?
I've heard that from several men over the years. My first experiences experimenting with progesterone was that it would stop my whiskers growing for a couple of days because a good dose of it blocks, that's one of its functions, is to block hormones that could interfere with pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
Progesterone puts everything down the middle when it's high in pregnancy. You don't want any stray hormones disturbing the pregnancy. So that's one of the functions of progesterone, is to aim at survival rather than whiskers or production of large amounts of collagen or bone material or anything. So it keeps things right down the middle.
Oh, so it's not necessarily a testosterone builder or a more anabolic thing, the progesterone cream?
No, it just blocks the stress. And if you get it at the right level, you don't have enough to block the testosterone, just enough to block the stress and leave your own testosterone.
So you're sounding like you wouldn't, for the guys, don't even mess with it. You wouldn't do it. Is that...
No. Most of the men that I've known who used it, it did shrink the penis and stop whisker growth.
It shrinks the penis?
Temporarily.
Why?
Because testosterone is maintaining the circulation, and the nitric oxide thing that causes vasodilation. That really isn't the mechanism of erection. It's testosterone, which gives muscle tone to the veins, which empty the penis. And the nitric oxide opens the vessels into the penis. So there doing the same thing in different ways, but the right amount of testosterone maintains a certain tone in the exit vessels, allowing a considerable amount of blood to stay there, even in the passive state.
Right. So I'm kind of confused. So this little dab of progesterone that many guys do to keep their testosterone levels up, is that, does it work? I mean, is that good? I mean, I'm kind of confused. Sorry.
At just exactly the right amount, it can leave the luteinizing hormone active and let the testicle continue producing an adequate amount of testosterone.
How would you know what just the right amount is?
I think only by trial and error, because I've known men who had anti-testosterone symptoms with 10 milligrams, others who felt an increase of testosterone with the same small dose.
So you'd have to be... Yeah, I think most of the progesterone, the one I saw from Dr. Wong, they talk about a little, and it's from yams, I think, just a little tiny bit, just a dab or so of this cream. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, wow, that gets a little tricky. You got to be careful with that. You mess around with that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Dr. Ray Pete is with us. Stay right there, Dr. Pete. We have lots to talk about this morning. It's an honor to have him on our show on the third Tuesday. If you care to have a question, you can just email patrick@oneradionetwork.com, patrick@oneradionetwork.com. We're learning quite a bit about hydrogen and some of the cool things that you can do that hydrogen does. You just Google molecular hydrogen, and a lot of fun things are going on in some of the more mainstream areas of life. With the stroke victims, they're using hydrogen along with oxygen to help the stroke victims to heal. And then we learned from Dr. Thomas Levy that oxidation, he believes, is one of the chief causes of disease. And then, you can hear the story right here on the promotion of this hydrogen thing, and it might be of interest to you. Whoop, I pressed the wrong button. Sorry, I just pressed the wrong button. I got it now. I got it. Previously, with the highly credentialed Dr. Thomas Levy, he argues because the literature shows that oxidation is the cause of disease.
But the whole point is the location, the concentration, the duration, the distribution of oxidized biomolecules determines 100% of all diseases. And so that's why I say oxidative stress doesn't cause disease. Oxidation is disease.
Is disease.
If there's no oxidized biomolecules, you don't have a toxin. The toxic effect is oxidation of biomolecules. That's the entirety of it.
And by the grace of God, several months ago, George Wiseman said this about hydrogen.
Hydrogen is the world's best antioxidant by a long shot.
Hmm.
First of all, it's 700 times smaller than something like CoQ10, 400 times smaller than vitamin C, things like that. So it can literally go, the hydrogen molecule can literally go through everything in your body and go right into the very DNA and repair it.
So now it makes sense why George was able to say this back in August 2019 with such conviction.
The body accepts that gas and uses it to heal everything. It's like the fountain of youth. It's astonishing the amount of ailments. In fact, in scientific studies, and they have over 1,000 scientific studies now, they are showing that it either helps the body heal directly or indirectly from virtually every ailment that ails any water-based life form.
Okay, I'm sold. And I was able to get one a couple of months ago, thanks to your support. It's called the AquaCure Hydrogen Machine. Breathe the gas and bubble the water. There's a promo code ONERADIO for 10% discount. I think a great investment for you, knowing what we know now, on OneRadioNetwork.com. So it's pretty cool. I've been really enjoying the hydrogen machine, and I can tell you there are some interesting things going on that I'm not sure why or something, but things are getting better for me. I'm sleeping better. I'm feeling just more comfortable in my body, which, you know, for me is just kind of a, you know, just something nice going on. I'm feeling some less the numbness in my little toes after a couple months on the hydrogen. Of course, I do some other things, so I can't honestly say for sure, you know, that's what it is. But we like it. We think there's a lot of science behind it. There is a lot of science behind it. We don't think we know. I saw one article that hydrogen was being used as medicine back in 1888. The Annals of Surgery recorded one of the very first publications that linked hydrogen to medicine. It referred to Dr. Nicholas Sen, who at the time was using hydrogen for intestinal applications. And then they have all the things here that you can look and check it out and see if what they just said is just made up or what. So it's interesting. I think there's something here for you. There's a lifetime warranty and then a 1 year money back warranty if you don't like it. And you just get it back. Okay, I've got to do one thing. Something just locked up on me quickly, but not to worry. I know how to do it. We got a little thing that does that. And I think that's going to work. And sorry. I think we're just 60 seconds away from Dr. Ray Pete.
Previously with Daniel Vitalis, we were talking about, pine pollen.
Pollen is essentially the equivalent of what an animal would have as sperm. Pollen is like the male part, the semen, and it fertilizes the ovum of the flower, which becomes eventually a fruit. And so if we were going to draw the equivalence, it would be like that the flower is like the female sex organ and the pollen is like the male sexual ejaculate. Well, pine trees, which sort of just dominate so much of the landscape of North America and so much of the world, pine trees, their semen, they dust the landscape in pollen. And that pollen, being the sort of male part of the plant, has some correspondences to male physiology in our species and many other animal species. So what I'm saying is pine pollen contains all of these different anabolic or androgenic hormones, plant versions of hormones that we need, like testosterone, like DHEA.
Well, the birds and the bees and the flowers and the trees, good stuff, guys, and few girls, too. Several choices of pine pollen. Any Sirthrival link, OneRadioNetwork.com.
Know the source. One Radio Network.
Pine pollen's on sale for 3 days. We have Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Big sale, pine pollen. Any of the Sirthrival links on OneRadioNetwork.com.
Know the source.
The source.
OneRadioNetwork.com.
It's the third Tuesday of the month, and Dr. Ray Pete, thank you so much, Doc, for coming on once a month. I'm getting emails from around the world. You got a lot of fans. How did all these people find you over the years? I'm real curious. I mean, you have a pretty standard kind of basic website, and you don't out there promote. People just found you?
Yeah, it's interesting. In the 70s, when I started giving out samples of thyroid and progesterone dissolved in vitamin E, the people got such tremendous results just giving it away to whoever happened by.
Is that right?
They started talking about the amazing things that happened with progesterone and thyroid, and it has just spread
by word of mouth. So long ago, you were actually giving out little samples of progesterone and vitamin E, and also the thyroid, the piggy thyroid in the vitamin E, and people were just...
I bought a small barrel of Armour thyroid powder, and at that time it was popular to use powdered kelp as a dietary supplement. And so I would put a little bit of Armour thyroid powder in with the powdered kelp and tell them it was a weak form of natural thyroid, and they were acquainted with the idea of using kelp as a supplement, but the thyroid was really the active component.
Interesting. So what kind of experiences were, and how much were you giving this little dose of the progesterone and the vitamin E? How much, what kind of experience were the guys having, the, and the women too, were having different good experiences?
One suicidal young woman, 21 or 22 years old, every 2 weeks she became absolutely suicidal, and her husband had hired a babysitter to keep her from killing herself, and finally committed her to the local psychiatric ward. But because it was cyclic, she was in for a week and was perfectly sane the week she was in. But as soon as she got out, she tried to turn on the gas and kill herself. So her husband brought her over, and she was sobbing as he brought her in, and I gave her a bottle of progesterone in oil and told her to go in the bathroom and spread it all over her body. And she came out and within 5 minutes had stopped sobbing.
Oh.
And the bulging veins on her hand disappeared as the next phase. 40 minutes after putting it on, she was smiling. And exactly 45 minutes after putting the oil on, she said, "It's like night turning into day. I wish I could always feel this good." And 2 weeks later, the same thing happened. She went into the suicidal state, and I had given her progesterone dissolved in oil, a vegetable oil, and it hadn't stayed in solution. So she had oiled herself, but wasn't getting the dissolved progesterone. So she was suicidal again.
Hmm.
But when I gave her some of the actual dissolved material, exactly the same cycle. The sobbing stopped, the veins disappeared, the smile, and at 45 minutes, exactly the same sort of from
experience,
black to white, yeah. Mood change.
Interesting. And the guys in general, what kind of things, feedback did you get from them? And how much progesterone were you giving in that little dose?
Two or three men rubbed it on their scalp every day and got fuzz to grow.
No kidding.
In about 4 or 5 weeks. They were getting probably 20 milligrams a day on their head.
Was that affecting raising testosterone levels to cause the hair to grow?
It was one of them that mentioned the mm-hmm. shrinkage thing. Yeah.
After all these years with progesterone for men, you have a kind of a gram or a milligram standard that you would kind of start guys at if they wanted to experiment with it?
I have 5 milligrams.
5 milligrams. I guess you could... I don't know how you'd measure that, but somehow. Really interesting. Dr. Ray Pete is with us. We have a lot of good emails. Patrick@oneradionetwork.com. Here's an email for you, Dr. Pete. Here's a gentleman that says, "You recommend 2,000 milligrams calcium per day. A concern expressed by other nutritionists is that calcium may not go to the bones, but into the soft tissue and other places, causing systemic damage over time. If one does take your suggestion, what are the prerequisite actions or physiological cell metabolism assumptions you are making for taking 2,000 milligrams? And what kind of calcium?"
I know there are still lots of doctors and nutritionists who have that idea, but what the parathyroid gland is constantly regulating, responding to conditions, and if you eat an excess of calcium and a moderate or low amount of phosphate, the parathyroid gland becomes very passive, especially if you have adequate vitamin D. And the parathyroid gland, its main function seems to be to take calcium out of the bone and bring it into the blood, but a side effect of taking it out of the bone is that it activates take-up by the soft tissue. And keeping the parathyroid gland as inhibited as possible leaves your bones unaltered. The calcium can still go in, but the parathyroid isn't going to be bringing it out of the bones into the bloodstream where it can affect the blood vessels. And when you eat an excess of calcium and have an adequate vitamin D level in your body, the calcium passes right through your kidneys into the urine. But if your parathyroid is active, it can form stones on the way out. The blood ability to keep it in solution changes, and it's that same change that causes it to go into the blood vessel wall. Carbon dioxide is the factor that keeps the calcium in solution in the bloodstream and stable in the bones. Calcium carbonate is the first molecule deposited in the bone, and it's gradually changed to calcium phosphate. But carbon dioxide is responsible for putting it into the bone. When the parathyroid hormone is active, it forms lactic acid in the bone, and it's lactic acid that dissolves, removes the calcium from the bone. So the balance of carbon dioxide versus lactic acid is under the control of parathyroid hormone in the bone. And that same process happening in the blood vessels, the carbon dioxide keeps the calcium dissolved, ionized in solution, but the lactic acid, if it is allowed to form either in the blood or blood vessels, that counteracts the carbon dioxide, precipitates calcium, and forms hardening of the arteries and kidney stones and so on. So keeping the parathyroid hormone low and your carbon dioxide production high relative to lactic acid is what's going to keep bones strong and arteries soft.
Arteries soft. That's why Dr. Cowan, the fellow on the heart, he's a proponent of keeping the lactic acid levels low. So that's probably why, because he knows it happens, or it's tied in with the calcium deposits potentially in the arteries.
And prolactin and cortisol and parathyroid hormone all tend to interfere with carbon dioxide production. Progesterone and thyroid are the things that most support the production of carbon dioxide and suppress the formation of lactic acid.
Suppress it. Yeah, this ties right in. Jerome says that I have some history of my grandfather and father having a stroke, one in the brain and one in around his heart. Can Dr. Pete give me some ideas how I can, some things I can do or not do to strengthen my arteries and veins so they don't have a problem later in life? It's a good question. So is that what a stroke is? Is a stroke where the veins will just actually kind of...
No, there are two main kinds of stroke.
Okay.
One in which a clot forms and plugs up the small arteries, and the other where a blood vessel breaks and leaks blood. It can form a giant clot outside of the blood vessel, so it's a bleeding stroke or a clotted stroke.
There's two different kinds. Let's first talk about...
And then there's another relatively harmless thing, which is a transient ischemic attack. That's where the arteries or capillaries close down because carbon dioxide isn't being produced.
So that's what they call these mini strokes, Doc?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So the ischemic kind of things, that these are, they're not good, but they're not life-threatening.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so before we get to the clot, let's talk about the carbon dioxide. We overbreathe, that releases carbon dioxide? Breathing fast?
You lose carbon dioxide when you breathe too hard.
Too hard.
And a low thyroid person is producing very little CO2, and so it takes very little overbreathing for a hypothyroid person to experience that constriction of blood vessels from loss of CO2.
Interesting. So that's another reason to keep that thyroid happy and in good shape, so you can retain more CO2.
Yeah. It's the low thyroid people who suffer high altitude sickness because to get more oxygen in thin air, they overbreathe.
Is clotting, going back to the Jerome's question on clotting on the potential strokes, is that the number one
cause? By far, in the United States at least, that's by far the most common type of stroke other than the transient ischemic.
Ischemic. And why do these little clots form? Do we know?
It isn't quite a deficiency of aspirin, but it's related to that. A serotonin excess, serotonin increases when you're under stress, and especially if you're hypothyroid.
Okay.
And hyperventilation raises the pH of your blood by blowing out the CO2, carbonic acid.
Right.
Carbonic acid should be keeping the pH of your blood towards the lower end of the range. And as the pH of the blood rises from hyperventilation, your platelets lose the ability to bind serotonin. And so serotonin rises in the blood when you hyperventilate. But serotonin in the brain stimulates respiration and makes you breathe harder. The doctrine for about 30 years has been claiming that serotonin produced in your intestine and carried in your bloodstream can't get into the brain to affect the respiration. But
it does.
In fact, very clear experiments have shown that the blood-brain barrier, as far as serotonin is concerned, really doesn't exist, because serotonin breaks down the barrier. So when it's high in the blood, it gets into your brain, makes you breathe harder. And if you're low in carbon dioxide to start with, it increases the release of serotonin into your bloodstream in a vicious circle.
And that could cause then the platelets to do their thing and clots.
And that's how an emotional stress, something that just makes you breathe faster.
Yeah.
If you're hypothyroid, it will start the cycle in which the pH rises, the serotonin is released from platelets, activates your brain to breathe harder, exacerbating the problem.
Fascinating. So can you conjecture then that just angst and tension and planet Earth and worry could be a really chief cause for these strokes that people have?
On the background of a low thyroid function.
On the background of a low thyroid. Because if Mr. Thyroid is happy and you have a TSH, I mean, way down, 0, 1, or 2 or something, and your body temperature is up, the body's not affected by stress as badly?
Because your progesterone and DHEA and pregnenolone are being produced generously by the well-circulated blood supply carrying sugar to all these tissues.
Wow.
Hypoglycemia is something that works with low carbon dioxide in the blood. They both tend to increase lactic acid, which wastes sugar. and makes the problem worse.
So low blood sugar actually creates lactic acid. But, I mean, we were taught that sugar is more acid and creates lactic acid.
Only if you're under stress and can't oxidize it. Thyroid and progesterone increase your ability to oxidize glucose into carbon dioxide, and the carbon dioxide, by regulating the pH, turns off lactic acid production. So it increases efficiency to increase your metabolic rate.
On the thyroid, how powerful of a metric is the body temperature, in your opinion, Dr. AP, for thyroid function?
It's almost the ruling factor. If you cool your body to 95 or 96 degrees Fahrenheit, it's essentially impossible to metabolize properly. You don't always metabolize rationally if your temperature is at 100 degrees, but it's a lot easier to get full oxidation all the way to carbon dioxide when you're
at the body's temperature.
And so the fever production is a curative thing. It's in a way, it's equivalent to giving a good supplement of thyroid, progesterone, sugar, and calcium, and so on.
We had talked to a doc a few months, maybe a month ago, who was suggesting if you get one of these little infrared thermometers, you ever see those? And you can, you know, about a foot away from your surface, and you can tell your surface temperature there. And he said if you did it on your big toe, if you're about 90 degrees, that's another indication that your thyroid is happy. Have you ever heard of that? Do you think that could be valid?
Adrenaline is protective. When your thyroid is low, you increase adrenaline and serotonin.
Right.
And a primary function of adrenaline is to keep the blood flowing to your brain and lungs and heart. And it will make your hands and feet get very, very cold. And a person can still be functioning very well, adapting to the low thyroid by keeping their brain and lungs and heart hot and well supplied with whatever sugar and oxygen are available. So the adrenaline takes the blood out of the extremities to keep things working in the core. So,
which is the cold hands and feet, right? That's the cold hands and feet. Right?
Yeah. And when you shake hands with a person on a warm day, if they have cold hands, they're very likely hypothyroid. Unless you're scaring them.
So a 90-degree toe with this thing could be a reasonable metric?
If the room is warm,
sure.
Your hands and feet should be reasonably warm. And when they're very cold, it means either that you're being frightened into high adrenaline, or that your thyroid isn't adequate to keep the heat up in the extremities.
Mm-hmm. Here's another question on thyroid. We always get a lot. A question for Dr. Pete. What is the mechanism for how proper thyroid function and stomach acid break down or neutralize oxalates in the diet? Does it matter how much oxalic acid is consumed? Also, how effective are mineral compounds like magnesium or potassium citrate at preventing the negative effects of oxalic acid? Do you understand the question?
If you're eating enough minerals, the calcium oxalate is likely to precipitate in your stomach and intestine and not even be absorbed. So I think the calcium and magnesium content of your food is protective by keeping it out of your system, keeping the oxalate out of your bloodstream.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Here's an email. I've been having trouble finding good thyroid supplement. Is there anything else to help me with my hypothyroidism?
I'm avoiding polyunsaturated fats.
Oh, PUFAs.
And don't eat an excess of uncooked cabbage or kale or other vegetables of that family. When they're raw, especially, they can be very anti-thyroid.
Anti-thyroid. Yeah. Somebody is asking about red light, putting a red light on your thyroid. What does Dr. Pete think about that to raise thyroid levels?
It does have an action, but what it's doing mostly is opening blood vessels, and that in itself can increase the production of thyroid.
Yeah,
but it affects the respiration of cells. Can increase efficiency locally.
Yeah. Do you think there's a? I've got an experience I just wanted to share with you, Doc. I've been putting black cumin seed oil on my thyroid and a little DMSO and go in the sauna, you know, and let it get hot in the infrared lights, and also using the red light and tapping a little bit and just kind of talking to it and being saying, Mr. Thyroid, get happier. And my body temperature has gone up really in the last month, probably about a half a degree.
So, what kind of oil?
Black cumin seed oil.
Yeah.
So you think there? So I'm kind of thinking maybe there is some toxicity I had going on, and that helped to get that out. I don't know why the black cumin seed oil being heated up would do that.
I think it is able to catalyze oxidative metabolism.
Oh, it's an oxidative. It's an antioxidant.
From the shape of the molecule, it looks like it would be a pro. Oxidative pro-thyroid factor.
But I've also been breathing. I've been breathing the hydrogen and the water too, so that could be helping. Very interesting. Yeah. So that might be something fun for you all to play with. I don't know. I can't give medical advice, but put some black cumin seed on your thyroid and put a little heating blanket on or something, or a red light. You know, it couldn't hurt though. I don't think. Here's a 58 or 68 year old man on NatureThyroid with healthy weight. And I've tried many diets, no processed foods and exercise, but still cannot cure type 2 diabetes. Don't want insulin or metformin. What would your experience suggest I try next? This is from Jim in Eugene, Oregon.
The getting a perfect, well-balanced diet is the first thing. Adequate calcium. A fairly high ratio of calcium to phosphate in your diet. Not too much meat or beans or nuts because of the high phosphate content in those relative to calcium. There are two main classes of food that provide a very high calcium magnesium content and low phosphate. Milk and cheese are one, and cooked greens is the other category. Vitamin D should be in the middle of the range, 50 or 60 nanograms per milliliter.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, you want to make sure that your thyroid is good, and the pH of the blood and the CO2 level are indicators of that, but I don't think blood tests are the most reliable way to measure your CO2. A breath analyzer is really a good.
Yeah.
Actually using carbon dioxide supplements, absorbing it through your skin or taking little bits of baking soda in water, that will actually suppress the lactic acid production if you do it in a graded amount, like a half a teaspoon in a half a glass of water a few times a day, will slightly increase the amount of carbon dioxide in your blood, which will increase the CO2 inside cells, adjusting the pH and suppressing the lactic acid production and shifting the cell to be able to oxidize the sugar. Diabetics, they talk about the sugar not being able to get into the cell, but right. that isn't true. It goes into the cell and it's turned to lactic acid is the problem.
Oh, so that insulin resistance thing talked about, Dr. Pete, you're saying that it's not the whole story. They got it wrong somewhere.
Yeah, stress increases the liberation of free fatty acids from your tissues. So apart from the amount of fat you're eating, it's the liberation of free fatty acids, which get into the cell and shift, block the ability of the cell to oxidize glucose.
Wow.
And when glucose isn't being oxidized, it's likely to be turned into lactic acid. And the lactic acid shifts the pH and starts the whole process.
Here is James. He's listening on Facebook. Can you please ask Dr. Pete some of the best ways to improve the health of my liver?
A good diet is the first thing. B vitamins are extremely important for getting things running. Selenium is essential for being able to use the thyroid molecules to put it into the right active T3 form. Carbohydrate is very important. But then you want to periodically check, have a blood test to see if your vitamin D and thyroid hormone is in the right range.
Mm-hmm. From Adrian, Dr. Pete talks about taking some good forms of sugar. Does he believe that the A1C blood test, which I think, and I'm just adding this point, isn't that over 90 days or something, is a reliable metric to see if I'm taking too much sugar?
No, I don't think
it
relates very closely to sugar because it will be influenced by breakdown of free fatty acids.
Right.
The polyunsaturated fats break down into fragments that look like the sugar fragments, but the fats are much more oxidizable and toxic.
The PUFAs are. It's easier to oxidize those guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so doing PUFAs actually raise your A1C.
As they break down.
But doing organic beet sugar or honey or maple syrup, that doesn't raise your A1C? Or if it does, do you care?
The numbers have been exaggerated so that lower than
I
think seven, they found that the sickest people weren't at the highest level.
So the numbers were cooked a bit for whatever reason.
It's a lot more complicated than just sugar causing that to rise.
It generally is with you, Dr. Pete. That's why we like you. Here's an email from Trent. I donate blood several times per year. What, in your opinion, in the optimal serum ferritin blood level for someone age 70?
I don't think ferritin is meaningful enough to worry about.
Don't even worry about it?
Watching your hemoglobin level at the low end of the normal range of hemoglobin, I think, is the safest place to be.
Say that again, please.
The low range, low end of the normal range for hemoglobin.
Okay.
Hemoglobin is the essential thing for delivering oxygen, and ferritin can go up and down according to inflammation, and keeping it in a moderate range usually means that you're not very sick, because sickness and inflammation will distort it greatly.
And what is the idea that we hear? Excuse me, did I interrupt you more?
The saturation of transferrin, the percentage saturation should be under 30, little under 30.
Under 30. So what is this idea of giving blood every so often to get rid of excess? Is it iron that people do this?
That was the traditional idea, that it would prevent the accumulation on a standard Western diet. Men constantly during their lifetime tend to accumulate iron. Women after menopause start accumulating it at the same rate because they aren't losing it. And so blood donors were seen to maintain an adequate level without so much accumulation with aging.
Mm-hmm.
But in the last several years, people are seeing that there are other things. One label for them was stressins, units created by stress, there are several different names for substances released into the bloodstream during stress and aging. And getting rid of those has a slightly rejuvenating effect.
Interesting. This is from Elmer. Please ask Dr. Pete the difference between taking something like Pogest E and pregnenolone powder, and also if I'm trying to lose fat, should we be drinking lower-fat milk?
I think milk is such an easy nutrient to get almost all of your nutrients that drinking 2 or 3 quarts a day is good for most people, but you don't want to drink that much whole milk if you aren't doing very hard labor to burn calories. So 1% is an average amount of fat for a person of average activity.
Mm-hmm. Totally anecdotal, Dr. Pete, but after starting to drink milk and more of it after talking to you over the past few months, raw milk that I'm just warming up a little bit of sugar in there, beet sugar, I've gained about, well, I'm starting to lift weights, but I've gained about 3 pounds already, and that's pretty unusual, that's very unusual for me. I haven't been able to gain weight pretty much my whole life. So that's interesting, interesting information, but it's whole milk, you know, grass-fed whole milk.
Milk contains small amounts of progesterone and thyroid.
Ah, okay.
In the Three Mile Island nuclear accident, lots of people, lots of babies were born without thyroid glands.
Huh.
But those who were breastfed, as long as they were being breastfed, the doctors didn't notice that they had no thyroid gland function.
Ah.
As soon as they were weaned, the absence of thyroid showed up, showing that the breast milk was keeping an adequate amount of thyroid to keep them growing. But cow's milk isn't as rich in thyroid and progesterone.
But you get a little bit, though. You get a little bit.
Yeah, that small amount adds to the effect of the calcium to stimulate your metabolic rate slightly.
Do we know, or is there any research or to show if there's a big difference between grass-fed milk and regular old milk, even if it's organic? Who knows what they're feeding them, organic feed? Do we know?
Food can be organic and still not be ideal.
There sure,
can be
of course.
Stinky weeds in the
That's
pasture
right.
that
can
make
feed
it
them.
Taste bad. But grass-fed milk has more vitamin E, according to the research.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But not necessarily... We don't know more hormones or progesterone or anything like that. We don't know that. We haven't seen anything there.
I don't think anyone has tested that.
Yeah. Good idea. That'd be great. Thanks for having Dr. Pete on as a regular guest. From Chris, before I ask my question, could you please convey my sincere gratitude for Dr. Pete for helping me deal with a heart issue? This helps me to get out of the clutches of the medical world. Here's my question. Why do feet swell up, especially when it is warm? The swelling reduces later in the day, and when it is cooler, but does not completely go away. I'm on 2 grains of natural thyroid and following Dr. Pete's dietary considerations, such as avoiding polys, PUFAs, drinking some milk and orange juice. Thank you. A little sweet, feet swelling, but it seems to when it's warmer.
I've heard that from quite a few people, but I don't really understand how it works. I think it's partly the shift of the nervous system. You let down your adrenaline a little bit when it's warmer, because adrenaline's function is to keep the blood up in your vital organs. Mm-hmm. And when it's warmer, you can reduce the adrenaline, and that relaxes blood vessels and lets any leakiness show up. I think it means that you're maybe not producing enough albumin in your liver, or having some other effect of an unbalanced estrogen level. Mm-hmm. Estrogen makes blood vessels leaky and reduces the formation of albumin in the liver. Mm-hmm. And albumin, working with sodium, is what keeps the keeps the fluid in the bloodstream rather than leaking out into your feet.
Mm-hmm. So the cold feet, then it's tied with the thyroid low, but then it's the adrenaline combination that's not getting the blood there to the extremities. Is that right?
Adrenaline, it keeps things working, but it changes the way they work.
So just speaking of estrogen, just came to me. Are these what birth control pills are? I don't know if they're very as popular as they used to be, but are these estrogen manipulators for the ladies? And are they dangerous?
Yeah, in the 30s, they already knew that estrogen prevented implantation or caused miscarriages. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to sell a miscarriage pill. And all through the 1940s and 50s, the drug companies realized that it would be a very profitable product to sell a birth control pill, but they didn't have the ideology that they knew it killed the embryo.
Whoa.
and they didn't want to have the drug company identified as baby killers. But in the 50s, someone thought up the idea that it isn't acting on the uterus, it's acting only on your brain and pituitary, and it's going to stop ovulation. If you can stop ovulation, you won't be accused of causing abortions.
But that was fake news.
I think so, there was no evidence. How can you see when a woman ovulates an ovum? In an animal, you can dissect them and watch the process and catch the actual ovum.
Yeah.
But in humans, it was simply declared rather than observed.
In general, do you know this? You may not know this, but are these birth control pills still very popular in our culture? People use them, girls, a lot? Do you know?
The first wave of them was causing sometimes fatal hemorrhages, often disabling strokes by causing clotting in the brain. So they reduced the amount of estrogen by about a factor of 10 from the first wave of contraceptives. Uh-huh. Made them more saleable, because so many women were having strokes or hemorrhages.
Oh. Yeah.
Still, the medical literature is heavily biased against recognizing any damage done by them. Still, the literature is out there showing that depression, various mood changes, movement disorders, restlessness, lots of problems are still associated with them.
Yeah. Dr. Pete, stay right there. Patrick Timpone, we'll do a quick little break here, and then we'll get into our last segment with Dr. Ray Pete, OneRadioNetwork.com. Please like these things on Facebook, our videos now, and on YouTube. Subscribe, and all these things help to kind of spread the word. And We appreciate that if you would do that. That would be totally cool. Kathy writes on Facebook today that forgot to mention, oh, she wrote two of them, but she said, Kathy says here, forgot to mention that sulfur was one of the first things that helped me to bring my health back and started me healing. Oh, that's very nice of you, Kathy. If you'd like to try our sulfur, we have a great product. Just go on our website, 2 pounds of sulfur for a particular price, and then another price for Canada, another price for worldwide. If you want more than 4 pounds, email me, patrick@oneradionetwork.com, and we'll take care of you.
Previously, Dr. Hal Huggins on detoxing mercury.
You do not have to get all the mercury out of the body. That's not what the problem is. It's the direction it's going. If you have more going out than you have coming in, then you're going to have a good chemistry. You're going to feel good. But if you have more going in to the body than going out, chemistries look bad and you feel bad.
If you had to name just a few things on the top of your list to help get mercury out, whether they be supplements or foods, give us your top five.
Okay.
Off the top of your head.
Best thing would be the infrared sauna. The thing is, detoxification is easy. Anybody can release a lot of mercury. But if you're using a sauna, or especially the infrared sauna, then you are eliminating the mercury through the skin, and you are bypassing liver and kidney. So that's a very good way to go.
It certainly is, Dr. Huggins. We love Dr. Huggins, and I'm sure he's doing well wherever he is. If you'd like to get one, just email me. These are great units, folks. You can see how they look here. There's no plugs. There's no wiring. There's no plumbing. Well, you just plug it in. There's two far infrared units at the front of this unit. If you look at the front, right at the first two, and you can do just one of those if you don't want it as hot. And this baby will get up there maybe 160, 170 degrees. And believe me, you'll sweat. And as I said, you know, I talked about Dr. Pete and the black cumin seed oil and my body temperature going up on my thyroid. Yeah, I put it all over my thyroid with a little DMSO. And then you just kind of scoot down in the chair, as you can see the lady there. And then your thyroid is covered. So you can use it. And you can do the black cumin seed oil. You can do it on your tummy or a little bit of turpentine, pure pine gum spirits on your tummy with DMSO. Well, you probably don't need it. And get in the so there's a lot of cool things you can do with this sauna. Also put turpentine or castor oil on the bottom of your feet, and that'll soak in there with a nice hot. So they're fun, and we'll get you one for $995 delivered continental U.S. And if you'd like to get one and you live around the world, just simply email me and we'll hook you up for a pretty good price. Now's the time to get them, $995. Have it for the holidays. Just email me, patrick@oneradionetwork.com. We love this product that you're seeing the picture of. It's called Pearlseum. Now, Chinese medicine and Ayurvedic medicine have used for thousands of years have used pearl for beauty, for longevity. You can use pearl on your face with a face cream. You can brush your teeth with it, which is amazing. And this, you can also take it internally. It's proven by science to really work. It's real live pearl, which I believe is calcium carbonate. I think that's what it is. And Dr. Pete, while he wasn't endorsing this product, he said the calcium carbonate was a good way to take calcium. So we thought so. And of course, it wouldn't be around for thousands of years if the pearls, you know, if the calcium was ending up in your arteries. You know, it just doesn't do it with this product. I would get two little green containers, and then put one in your bathroom, one in your where your supplements are. Brush your teeth with it. You can take a little bit before bed. It helps you to sleep. It's a very nice product. Pearlseum, real pearl. That's all there is in there. Nothing else. Real pearl from OneRadioNetwork.com.
We talk about your health, wealth, and well-being on OneRadioNetwork.com.
Dr. Ray Pete has a website, and you can check it out. It's raypete.com, and we always put a link on his show page, and you can click on there and support Dr. Pete's work by getting his newsletter, which comes out, Dr. Pete, every couple months, right? Every 2 months?
2 months, yeah.
Every 2 months. What's your latest one about?
Progesterone.
Oh, of course. Progesterone.
It'll be out in about 2 weeks.
And you look at your bio, I mean, you were looking at this, 50 years ago?
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm putting in a little bit of the history, but bringing it up to date, putting in some of the recent carbonic acid, carbon dioxide connections.
Yeah, yeah. Here's an email. What's the percentage, or what percent of tryptophan ingested from food is converted to serotonin?
That depends on your level of stress and other things, but it can be very high when you're under stress. Other times, very little of it.
Mm-hmm. This is an interesting question. Is risk taking in life conducive or not to be to the state of learned helplessness? Is risk taking involved in being in the state of learned helplessness? Do you talk about learned helplessness?
Oh, quite a bit.
Yeah.
Serotonin turns on the stress system, but it can also turn off the adaptive things, such as production of progesterone. And you can break out of learned helplessness by increasing your energy. Thyroid is a crucial thing in stopping learned helplessness.
And what exactly is learned helplessness?
The term relates to the old studies in which they convinced a rat that escape was impossible. The animal in that state would allow itself to drown very easily because it saw no use in swimming. Its heart would simply stop after maybe just a few minutes of resisting. But if they put the animal in that tortured situation that caused it to become helpless, if they then showed it some exit possibility, it in effect vaccinated it against stress, so that when dropped into the water, instead of drowning in a few minutes, sometimes they would resist and swim for more than a day.
Interesting.
Simply a mental change, something they learned. That's why it wasn't called a physical thing. It was a learned helplessness.
I see. Somebody wants to know, is that Mexicoke that you two were talking about, does it have cocaine in it?
Which thing?
Mexicoke.
I think all coke is made from an extract of the coca leaf,
mm-hmm.
but they around 1940 were told to remove the cocaine, and so there are molecules closely related to cocaine that I think are beneficial, some of the same benefits that the coca leaf chewers have for endurance and anti-inflammatory and such, but according to the official analysis, the real cocaine has been removed.
Mm-hmm. Would you ask Dr. Pete to talk about free will and determinism?
That might take a while.
Well, if you're into it, we are. We have no place to go. It's up to you, sir.
I think we, life in general, things in general, I think we are determined to have free will.
Hmm.
It's part of our nature, of the nature of every living thing. I mentioned the formation of soot molecules, extremely complex, organized, symmetrical molecules formed spontaneously when methane explodes. You get some carbon dioxide, oxygen consumes the hydrogens, but the carbon atoms have an intrinsic ordering principle. They spontaneously organize into these very, very big complex molecules. And I think that spontaneous tendency to improve things, create order out of chaos, mm-hmm. I think that's where determinism affects free will, so that the situation, the carbon atoms didn't have a written plan for what they were going to do, but it was in their nature, given the opportunity to create high orders of organization. I think our inherent free will is intending to create high level order.
As we press forward, moving in our life, our free will is what's creating order and more peace and love. And
in other words, mm-hmm. I think we're biased against the creation of chaos.
Yeah.
And inclined towards the creation of order.
Yeah, I like that. That's great. Good for you. As women get older, Ellen wants to know, what are signs of low progesterone? As women get older, what are signs of low progesterone? Okay.
I'm just about everything in aging. It's so at the center of life and stability for example, weakening bones, loss of elasticity in the skin, loss of moisture and oil production in the skin, stiffening of joints and arteries, a change, reduced curiosity and initiative, less interest in adventure, more interest in security, everything from mental processes down to the smallest.
Wow. And is this for both male and female in general?
Yeah.
I've been listening to several of your shows, and you have a Dr. Pete. I think they're just great. Thank you so much for having come on. Well, it's our pleasure. Here's a question. Recently, I've seen new cookware in department stores, titanium ceramic nonstick. Does Dr. Pete think this would be safe to use? Titanium ceramic nonstick.
Without seeing any tests of it, I would refrain from using it to cook anything acidic, because ceramics, unless they're specially designed to resist acid and corrosion, you wouldn't want to cook a tomato sauce on it, for example, in case it might release titanium into your food.
So generally, though, we've heard that the pure ceramic, like La Creuset, that expensive stuff, is good cookware. Is that your opinion as well? Pure ceramic or not? Did I hear you say not with spaghetti sauce?
Ceramics, remember, lead-based ceramics were a major problem. Ceramics aren't necessarily acid resistant. Hmm. It takes some special chemistry to... The more it's like a simple silicon glass surface, the safer it is.
So glass is really I don't know if they even make it anymore. I think it's Vision cookware. You can find them online. I got a whole set on eBay, but I think that's probably some of the best, right? Glass.
Oh, sure. That's what I've been using for years.
Yeah. Like I say, folks, they don't sell it anymore. It's called Vision cookware, but you can go on eBay and buy a whole set for pretty inexpensive. I don't know, people just stocked them up when they knew they were going out of style or something. This is a good one. Oral micronized progesterone, is it equal to Progest-E in its effect?
That's what the drug companies are now saying. For several years now, they've been selling progesterone, usually in an emulsion or just a paste of peanut oil and micronized progesterone. So the progesterone is mostly in a crystalline, though micronized, mm-hmm. form. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that, as your bile emulsifies the peanut oil, very little of the progesterone goes in the solution, because peanut oil isn't a great solvent. Like the girl I mentioned that had no effect from the vegetable oil dissolved progesterone, because it had crystallized out in a period of 2 weeks. Some of it, as it contacts the micronized crystals, contacting your intestine surface, will be taken up. Molecules released from the crystals will go directly from your intestine to the liver, and will then be attached to a sugar-like molecule, glucuronic acid, which then circulates through the body but quickly leaves in the urine. That causes the progesterone to have a very different effect from the natural form that circulates in the fats. And so when it's dissolved in vitamin E, as it's emulsified by the bile, breaks up and enters the form of chylomicrons, which enter the body in a very different pathway, going through the wall of the intestine into the lymphatic vessels, which then the chylomicrons dump into your general circulation, bypassing the liver. And the chylomicrons we normally process our fats through this system, and this lets the progesterone distribute through the whole system, getting equilibrated under red blood cells, under the cholesterol-carrying proteins, and other cells, so that it can pass endlessly through the liver in these forms. The red blood cells can keep it in circulation for more than a day after one dose. It goes into the red blood cells from the chylomicrons, for example, to be at a higher concentration inside the cell than in the serum, where the micronized progesterone, as far as it hits the intestine wall, it is going straight to the liver to be glucuronidated and excreted.
How do you remember all this stuff?
Is
it right? You're 83 revolutions around the sun. You were 83.
Yeah.
Wow, man. Whatever you're doing, sir, you're doing something good. You remember all that stuff?
Seeing the pattern.
Yeah.
The way a cat learns, for example. They can keep a cat in a cage for a long time, but once it sees how the lock works, if it's some sort of a latch, once it sees the way out of the cage, it never forgets.
That's great.
But if you teach it something by rote, it'll forget it the next day.
You get it at a deep level of who you are, because of your passion, and it's like it's there for you. It's not like you have to remember a phone number or something.
It's seeing how things work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fascinating. James is on Facebook, says, I don't have set meal times, and I just kind of follow my hunger signals. Is this negatively affecting my circadian rhythms? Is there anything else I should care about? Just eating when you're hungry?
I don't really think so. I think it's... okay to eat whenever you feel like it. The experiments on mice claim that it's good to go a long time to fast for a while, but a lot of things are involved. Mice are nocturnal animals. They normally eat at night, and just changing their schedule creates such stresses that it's hard to extrapolate from rodents to people, especially things like eating.
Yeah. Ellie says, I'm fascinated with the conversation about milk. I've never really thought about drinking milk. And I was just wondering, I'm kind of an extreme girl. Could you really just live on good milk? I mean, could you live? Could you? I guess you could.
People have
fasted on
a milk diet of 30 to 60 days on just milk, but you get iron deficient if you try to live on it, because the pregnant woman's high estrogen causes her to absorb a very large amount of calcium and iron. So the baby comes out very highly charged with iron, and to overcome that load of iron, it has to have a diet essentially free of iron for up to a year, so that it grows into the large amount of iron that it has stored in its liver and bones.
Interesting. So it's all set up so when they're just nursing with nothing else, it's get everything. So and later on, though, you don't have the iron. Yeah, that's fascinating. Yep. Yeah. How would you supplement the iron if you wanted to do milk for a long time?
Eggs are a very good source.
Yeah. Ray Pete mentioned on the last show wearing a sleeping hat. Does it matter what it's made out of?
Not at all, as long as it's comfortable and warm.
And so what's going on at night? I like to wear these little socks, you know, and put some oil on the winter, you know, like sesame seed oil, and then put these little socks on. That's kind of fun.
When tissues get below, I think it's about 90 degrees, your hands and feet easily can get down to that temperature. The cells start producing, the white blood cells passing through those cold areas will start producing inflammatory signals, which they carry up to the rest of your body. So cold feet really can affect your brain.
Yeah, maybe that's why Ayurveda's talked about doing the sesame oil, you know, at night and putting these little socks on. And yeah, it's kind of fun, especially in the winter when it's so dry. It's a very nice thing, so you all might try that. Ian writes in, I would like to ask Dr. Pete's opinion on the cause of vertigo and what he would do to combat it, vertigo.
A very common cause is toxic bacterial growth in the intestine causing a surge of serotonin leading to a balance that shifts water into your vestibular apparatus that governs your balance. That's probably 90% of the cases of vertigo, but there are other
reasons,
types that involve a serotonin, dopamine, and histamine imbalance farther down in your brain, not just in the balance apparatus itself, but in the brainstem, the reticular apparatus that feeds the information to your balance system. Maybe 1 or 2% of the vertigo people are having a chemical imbalance farther down. But the first thing to concentrate on is cleaning up your intestine.
Intestines, wow. Yeah. Well, Dr. Pete, I think we did pretty good today. Thanks for sticking around so long. We really always enjoy talking to you. So what are you going to have for Thanksgiving, like turkey and stuff and everything?
I think so, turkey or maybe a lamb roast.
Lamb roast or something, yeah. And your newsletter, we'll put a link on our show if people want to get that for you. How much is it? Very inexpensive. Very affordable.
$28 by email.
For a year, right?
I'd like to mention a book that people can find on It was written in 1905, called Carbonic Acid in Medicine, by Achilles Rose and Robert Kemp. Has some very interesting stuff about the history of therapeutic use of carbon dioxide.
Oh, cool.
It's just now starting the last 5 years to come back into medicine as a therapeutic anti-inflammatory.
Carbon dioxide.
Yeah.
So it's the name of the book is Carbonic Acid?
In Medicine.
In Medicine. And the author?
Achilles Rose.
Rose. You can probably get it on Amazon or somewhere?
It's free. I don't know exactly where I found it, but it is on the internet.
Oh, you can find it. You can find it somewhere.
Yeah, for no cost.
Well, it's pretty interesting that all our political heroes want to tax CO2, so I am not sure what that's about. I mean, if it's so good for you, why would you tax it? Don't worry, you don't have to respond to that. Dr. Pete, thank you. We love your work, and we love you, sir. And you take care, and we'll see you next month, okay?
Oh, okay, thank you.
Thank you, bye.
Bye.
Yeah, you didn't have to mess around with that one. Yeah. Well, great fun. You get so many emails about Dr. Pete and having him on the show, and we're glad to do it. He's just a great guy to talk to, huh? So we are going to go out in the sun, thank you very much, and hang out there for a while. The Real World of Money with Fred Dashefsky he'll be here tomorrow. And Fred's a neat guy. He's, he stays on as best he can with everything that's been going on in his life. And there's so much cool stuff to talk about with the money thing. Let me find my slide that I want to take off. So he'll be here tomorrow. And then we're going to talk to a gentleman. His name is Dan Root. And he is really doing some interesting work with the sauna, with niacin and the flushing and the whole thing. So that'll be fun, a detox. So we're going to do that on Thursday, maybe somebody else. So thank you, and appreciate you being here. Please spread the word on Now That We're Video and even all the audio. Remember, we have about 3,000 podcasts and audio on our website, One Radio Network, and you can go there and put your whatever you're interested in our search function. And it's a pretty good one. I mean, it'll find a lot of things, either a particular thing like thyroid or detox or put a person's name in there. You'd be surprised after 12 years on this show of how many people we've talked to. So we get folks a lot will say, why don't you have this person? And I always check my search engine first on our One Radio Network, and generally, we've already talked to them, but that doesn't mean we can't do it again. So let us know people you'd like to hear from. Thanks for your ongoing support. Please like us on Facebook and YouTube and subscribe and all that stuff, all that geeky stuff, and that helps spread the word. So we'll talk about money tomorrow at 9 o'clock. Bring your money questions to Facebook and also to One Radio Network. And remember that you're doing the best you can. I mean, regardless of what anybody says, you are doing the best you can. We all are. Every moment, we're doing the best we can. So I love you all very much. Thank you. And we'll see you tomorrow, OneRadioNetwork.com.
We are listener-supported, One Radio Network.